So where we left off, we were talking about this idea of challenges, of what we call Yesurin. So this, I think this is, I might have cut out one or two of the cases, but this next part is a grouping. And so I'm gonna we'll go through it, and then I'll tell you what I saw. It's always very interesting to see like the different approaches to trying to understand what happened there. Wait, hold on. Okay, so in terms of understanding this, how the Gemara is laid out here, and what is going on here. You'll see the story in a second. But I just lost Hugh, so let me stop the share for a second. See if he comes back on. By the way, I love the background, Eric. That's a great, that's a beautiful painting over there with the Hams on it.
This is a real room. This is not like a fake background.
No, I know, it looks great. Okay, I don't know what happened to you. Okay, when he comes back on. So I'll bring the screen back up. Should be able to share, okay. I think if he pops, leave that over here. Okay, all right, here we go. So it says like this, that the Gemara continues to address the issue of suffering and affliction. Rav Yochanan's student, Rav Chiya bar Abba, fell ill. Rav Yochanan entered to visit him. And, okay, no problem. And, where's my, I've lost my screen share again. Here we go. Okay. All right. So, yeah, so he fell ill. So Rav Yochanan entered to visit him and said to him, is your suffering dear to you? Do you desire to be ill and afflicted? Rav Chiya said to him, I welcome neither the suffering nor its reward. As one who welcomes the suffering with love is rewarded. So Rav Yochanan said to him, so give me your hand. And Rav Chiya bar Abba gave him his hand, and Rav Yochanan stood him up and restored him to health. Okay? Next case.
Jonathan, I have a question for you.
Yeah, real quick. Yeah.
When it says suffering or reward, when we talk about reward, isn't that usually related in some way to study or mitzvot or something like that?
Well, let's see. I'll remind you that last time we talked about the idea of suffering, that or the challenges, what it helps is, let's say we call them Yesurin Shel Ahava. So challenges or suffering of love, that let's say, for example, you had difficulties and you're going through a very difficult spot. So then the first thing was to do is to look at yourself and say, self-introspection, have I done anything?
Okay.
Right?
I remember the okay? whole, all right, that was last week.
So then, right, so this is what it's like a little bit of a continuation, but and we'll see. Okay, it's important to keep this in mind because this point of the fact that, so again, so remember we one of the points that we said last time was that when you have suffering, go through the list. Let's look at what we have. So first thing we'll do is we'll look at where can I improve? If it wasn't that, we were supposed to look at a Torah study, and if not that, then we're calling these things, you know, suffering Yesurin Shel Ahava. Suffering or difficulties out of love. And then we explain that basically that idea of that last level, we'll call it, that was that idea of that of suffering of love was really to be able to help someone reach or attain a level, a higher level than like almost like raising the person away from any of their physical limitations to go to a higher spiritual plane. Okay, so now with that in mind, these three, we have three cases here And we have to ask ourselves, what's going on? Okay, so the first case was Chiya Bar Abba got sick. Rav Yochanan, his teacher, came. He says to him, Chavivin Alech Yisurin, are you enjoying these? Or are these, is the suffering dear to you? And he says to him, no, I don't like them. I don't like the reward. He gives him his hand. Rav Yochanan basically helps him get better. The difficulties, the suffering goes away. Next case. Similarly, Rav Yochanan fell ill. So Rav Chanina entered to visit him and said to him, is your suffering dear to you? Rav Yochanan said to him, I welcome neither the suffering nor its reward. I don't like either. Lohain v'loscharn, I'm not interested. Amale havli yadach, yahavli yadeh v'okme. So then Rav Chanina gave him his hand. Give me your hand. He gave him his hand, and Rav Chanina stood him up, and restored him to health. Third case. Oh, as a parenthetical, the Gemara asks, why did Rav Yochanan wait for Rav Chanina to restore him to health if he was able to heal his student? Let Rav Yochanan stand himself up. Like, right? I mean, if he knows that you can get out of this thing, so why didn't he get himself better himself? What did he need help? So the Gemara answers, they say a prisoner cannot generally free himself from prison, but depends on others to release him from his shackles. Okay? So he needed someone else. He couldn't do it on his own. Okay? Very important side point here. That when a person is sick, so we pray for the sick person, the strongest and most powerful prayer that can be done on behalf of a sick person is the sick person himself. But with that said, sometimes you're so not well that you just don't have the energy or the strength. And that's this idea. Rav Yochanan was so ill that he couldn't get himself out. That's what it means, this idea that a prisoner cannot generally free himself from prison, but depends on others to release him from his shackles, is that idea. Right, he's so not well, you need the assistance of another. So even though he knew the possibility existed, couldn't do it himself. Okay, next, third case. The Gemara relates that Rabbi Elazar, another of Rabbi Yochanan's students, fell ill. Rabbi Yochanan entered to visit him and saw that he was lying in a dark room. The Gemara doesn't explain this, but we're going to see from the Gemara that basically Rabbi Elazar was pretty poor. And so Rav Yochanan exposed his arm, and light radiated from his flesh, filling the house. He saw that Rabbi Elazar was crying, and he said to him, why are you crying? Thinking that his crying was over the suffering that he endured throughout his life, Rav Yochanan attempted to comfort him. If you're weeping because you did not study as much Torah as you could have liked, as you would have liked, we learned one who brings a substantial sacrifice or one who brings a meager sacrifice have equal merit, as long as he directs his heart toward heaven. And if you're weeping because of lack of sustenance and are unable to earn a livelihood, as Rabbi Elazar was indeed quite poor, not every person merits to eat off of two tables, meaning one of wealth and one of Torah. So you need not bemoan the fact that you're not wealthy. And if you're crying over children who have died, this is the bone of my 10th son, and suffering of that kind afflicts great people, and they are afflictions of love. So this is, again, as a side, Rav Yochanan had 10 children that passed away during his lifetime. And it says that he walked around with a memento, it says here, a bone of his 10th son, or something of that reminded him of that. So that's a whole nother discussion, right? Okay, we'll touch on that a little bit. But let's just go here. We'll focus on this one point, and then we're going to go. So Rabbi Elazar said to Rav Yochanan, what was it?
How many children did he have?
I think he had a lot, but clearly the idea of just losing one child is enough, you know? And the Gemara before, like I skipped over, there was one case of where it talks about that if you, God forbid, lose a child in a lifetime, that it's that wipes away all of your sins, which is, you know, okay. I don't want to go into that today. But so Rav Yochanan had that challenge in his life. So Rabbi Elazar said to Rabbi Yochanan, I'm not crying over my misfortune, but rather over this beauty of yours that will decompose in the earth. As Rabbi Yochanan's beauty caused him to consider human mortality, Rabbi Yochanan said to him, over this it is certainly appropriate to weep. Both cried over the fleeting nature of beauty in the world and death that eventually overcomes all. And then, meanwhile, Rabbi Yochanan said to him, is your suffering dear to you? Rabbi Elazar said to him, I welcome neither this suffering nor its reward. Upon hearing this, Rabbi Yochanan said to him, give me your hand. Rabbi Elazar gave him his hand, and Rabbi Yochanan stood him up and restored him to health. Okay? So those are three cases of someone suffering from some kind of very intense illness, and to have this question asked, is the suffering dear to you or not? And all three have the same response, no. Someone sticks out their hand, pulls them up, heals them, and they move on. So the question is, what's going on, right? This is like, you know, like Gemara again, it's very, it's not to be taken lightly. So the question is, what's going on here? So any ideas before I give you some suggestion?
And also, they're other than the names, they're exactly the same response.
Very similar, right? I mean, the, yeah.
But they're not exactly the same.
Right.
Each one is a little different. So there's definitely a nuance there that's trying to be said. I can't figure out what it is. But the third one clearly is much different than the other two.
Right.
There's a much longer explanation. But the first two are a little different, but not much.
Not much, right. Except that you have like a side point, whereas the first one, okay, let's look back again. So the first case is that Rav Yochanan came into Chia Bar Abba and then helped him get out of it, so that when Rav Yochanan has the same situation, you'd wonder, and that's what the Gemara asked, like, why didn't Rav Yochanan, knowing that you can get yourself out of this type of thing, why not do it himself? And we realize that you can't. Sometimes you're just not in the position to do it yourself, especially if you're really like in a bad state. But it does teach us a side point that, without realizing that was the Gemara was going towards, like, the preferable thing would be to get yourself out of that situation on your own. You know, to try to do like self-healing, so to speak, would be the best. Only the problem is that it's not always available. Okay, but the third case is a lot going on there, right? Because there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot more going on in this case that the Gemara relates to Rabbi Elazar, right? There's a lot going on in that case. But each three, like you said, have the similar ending. Is this, like, you know, again, the associative principle of them tying the three cases together. And of course, Rav Yochanan happens to be in all three. One says the person is suffering, and the other two is the person who helps them out. Now, just as a side, let's just think about this for a second. The case of Rabbi Elazar, so when he's crying there, and Rav Yochanan thinks, oh, maybe it's the fact that he had a hard life, that he necessarily, you know, so are you bemoaning the fact that you were poor? So, no, that didn't bother me. You're bemoaning the fact that maybe you think that you didn't get to study enough Torah, and he's like, no, that's not it. But it's interesting that we see that. It's not about how great the person, what they attained, as much as their effort, and that they had in mind that they were doing it for the right reasons, like they were doing it for the sake of heaven. But then it's interesting, it takes a turn here when it says, I'm crying over the fact of the beauty that's going to be lost. So the... What?
It's like he's in there, like he's sick and has no money. It's like, all I'm now worried about is that there's going to be beauty in the world that's lost. Like,
right, so...
You're like a non sequitur, you know?
Right, right. So what is this beauty? So the Gemara talks many times, makes references to Rav Yochanan's beauty. There's a story, which is, we'll have very soon, not very soon, but it comes up that Rav Yochanan used to sit outside of the mikveh. And the reason he would sit outside the mikveh is that when the women would come out of the mikveh, which meant that they were going home to be with their husbands, and that was, like, I guess, the opportune time to conceive, that they would see Rav Yochanan's beauty, and that their children would be, have a positive impact, that they would be beautiful like Rav Yochanan. Such interesting idea. Again, the Gemara talking about his beauty. So the commentators here explain that Rav Yochanan was from Jerusalem, and he had a beauty from the times of the temple, even though he didn't necessarily live at that time, but there was a certain beauty of the people who had lived through the temple period. That there's something very unique and special and beautiful about those people who experienced that and anybody that came in touch with that. So that's what I think. So when you put it in that framework, Rabbi Lezer, who's a very holy person, and sees Rav Yochanan's beauty, he's making a reference to a beauty of a world that didn't exist any longer. And that he was saying there, and if you put that in here, he'd say, I'm crying over the misfortune of, but rather of the, I'm sorry, I'm not crying over the, my misfortune, but rather over this beauty of yours that will decompose in the earth. Meaning that there's going to be that loss of that beauty of Jerusalem of yesteryear that you represent. And to that, they both said, wow, yeah, that's something worthy of crying. But it brings us back to this thing about each story ends with this line. Is your suffering dear to you? And they're like, no, I'm not. I don't want the suffering. And okay, fine. So if we link it back to what we studied last week, what this idea of the Yisurin Shel Ava, that one suffers, and it's, again, the suffering and challenge that one is in confronting is not based on some kind of negative, you know, like we go through the checklist. I'm not doing, I've perfected, or I've really gotten over, I've been able to master all these different issues that I had. I'm not lacking in Torah study, which means I'm connected very much so. So then the Yisurin are coming to take you to a different level. So I forgot who I saw this, who said this. Oh, yes. Okay. So Rav Kook. So Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Palestine, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who is a unbelievable, like we're talking a big, big person. So he has a commentary on Brachot and on Shabbos, which I don't have, but I have the one on Brachot, and it's not easy. He's a very flowery, also very deep writer. So it's like something that you have to really work hard to attain. But here he says like this. He says, what the issue was is that these Yisurin are coming to help you get to a higher level, which we said last week. It helps you get it actually helps you get to even a higher spiritual plane.
What do you say? These what gets you there? These Surin?
These Surin, these difficulties, these challenges. Troubles, right? So what they're all saying the same thing, and that is, and they have the story of the Vilna Gaon. There was a story of the idea that some of these very holy people had an angel come and study with them. So they have the Vilna Gaon. Hold on. So the idea basically of accessing higher levels of understanding without necessarily doing effort. It was almost like there's effort. I work really hard and I'm trying to understand. And then there are times when it just comes to you without the effort. So the Vilna Gaon, they say, the angel, so to speak, came to him to help him. And he said, I'm not interested. Go away. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to attain this on my own with my own effort. I don't want handouts. So in
here's what I think. I think that this theme and the theme from last week as well is all about humility. You have, at some point in your life, you have to depend on somebody and trust somebody else to help you. You know, when you say, like, the idea that, like, you can only say, you're supposed to say Shema before you go to bed as well, because you're going to this vulnerable time. But if you're so learned in Torah, you don't have to say it. But that seems like the conclusion was no. You better remind yourself that everybody needs to have some help or in some way, and you have to have humility. And I think that, like, if he's sending the angels away, what was the result of that? Was he able to learn more on his own, or did it come to that he needed somebody to help push you?
So he what he's saying is, I'm not begrudging any type of help per se, but saying, if we're saying that what the equation was, that through the difficulties that are meaning that there's challenges that are sent to us because we need to rectify certain things. There are challenges that are sent at us because we're not necessarily raising ourselves to levels that we could. So therefore, it's saying to us, you need to spend more time in growth. Torah means growth. Now, if I got those two and then I'm still getting that, it's because it's trying. There's a hand that's coming to pull us up even higher. And they're all saying the same thing. I'm not interested in that. I want to get up and do it on my own. I don't necessarily want the handout. So you want to say, okay, but you want to still take help from others. You can't just do it all on your own. I'm not saying that they're not saying that they. And if anything, you see that Rav Yochanan coming or whoever it is in the story that comes to help pull them up. Here, hav li yadech. Here, give me your hand, right? And then. And he stood him up and restored him to health. So he's clearly taking help from someone. But he's saying, I don't want this form of challenge to help me get to that next level. I want to get there on my own without that outside, you know, type of impact. You hear it or no?
Yeah, so, it's early. When I was saying, I wasn't saying the stories were the same. I was saying it was interesting that the responses through each of this different things was the same response, which is, you know, I welcome neither the suffering nor the reward, regardless of what the different level of these challenges that each of these rabbis had, right? So their response was still the same, which I thought was interesting, because that feels like the levels of their suffering or what they went through was on a different plane.
Based on the way Rav Kook is approaching it, he's saying that the idea of this next level, where you have a suffering that's taking you to it's not the first two, you know, check of I need to do this, I need to fix certain things. Now we're saying I fixed all these things, I'm on this next plane. That they're like, I don't want this, and I don't want this type of reward. I want to get my reward by earning it. You know, that's basically, because it says, lohin velo schara, not them. I don't want the suffering or their reward. So he's focusing on the idea that this somehow you're getting a reward without necessarily earning it, you know? And that seems to be, like, that's kind of what Rav Kook is saying, that that's kind of what bothered them, that they were bothered by that idea of like saying, are you going to take me to this next level without me having to like roll up my sleeves and like do something on myself? I can't just like, you know, get that hand out from God because he's pushing me through this like difficult spot. I'm not interested in that. If that's how it's going to be, I'm not interested. I mean, all three have that similar answer because they're like, no, we are going to. And then I get, you have all these, you know, you have the story with Rabbi Lazar and a little bit extra, you know, material there, which I guess maybe it's fleshing it out a little bit more, but you see this idea of that, again, on the backdrop of what we talked about last week about that suffering, that it brings you to this higher level. They're like, I'm not interested in the free ride. I want to earn it. That was how Rav Kook understood it. Anybody else want to say something?
Couldn't you read it like, let's say you're sitting around suffering, you have some affliction that's befalling you. Somebody comes in and says, hey, Jonathan, are you enjoying the learning experience that this suffering is bringing to you, the profound experience that's going to help you get to the next level? And the guy responds like, no, look, I'm done with the profound experience. I don't like the suffering. Let's just, I just want to get past this.
Right.
Like not like, oh, don't give me the free ride. Oh, God's giving me this suffering. I prefer to learn it on my own. I could do without this suffering. Let me try and get there without the profound learning experience. I know this is supposed to bring me to a higher level, but prefer to be done with it.
Right. So, I guess he was saying like that. So they're framing this suffering here as being a little bit. It's a different type of. It's not necessarily your classic challenge per se. You know, it's like we're saying basically at this point, it's more than that. They've gone. And you know what? Actually, let's look at this a second, because based on what you're saying, think about this for a second. Rabbi Elazar's case, maybe that's what he's bringing in here. Rabbi Elazar had a very difficult life. He was a poor guy. Rabbi Elazar, what happens? Rabbi Yochanan entered to visit him and saw that he was lying in a dark room. So that's the backdrop of that story. The guy's had a life of difficulty. He's been a poor guy. He's got no electricity or no lamp. He's missing lacking the basic, you know, needs. Like, right? I mean, we all like, you know, having a lamp with light. That's kind of like a common thing that we should all, you know, we all kind of expect to have. He doesn't have that, and that's not what's bothering me though. I'm not bothered by that. He says, right. So, or if you're crying about the fact, you know, that's, and then he says, no, I'm not crying over my misfortune. That's not what's bothering me. I'm crying in this case because I'm witnessing the fact that Rav Yochanan, you represent this beauty of Jerusalem that's going to be lost. That's what's bothering me. So that's, you're talking about a type of guy, right? None of that bothers me. I'm not bothered by the lack of wealth. I'm not bothered by these issues. I feel like I'm getting my stuff done with my study. So he's right. He's addressing, it's kind of like the, you know, he's addressed his other issues. No, what bothers me is that I feel that there's a certain beauty that's going to be lost. The beauty of, let's say, you know, we talk about Jerusalem having 9/10 of the world's beauty. And we go there and we say, it's nice. They're definitely aesthetically more beautiful places in the world than Jerusalem, but there is something very, there's, that's this idea. If like you listen to the way he's saying, I'm crying over that beauty, this beauty that's going to decompose in the earth. The beauty of Jerusalem is, yeah, aesthetically there's something nice about it, but there's something beautiful about it that goes much deeper than just what we see with our eyes.
Where do we pull in the idea of Jerusalem here?
Okay, so that was the beauty that he's... Okay, so the over the beauty of Rav Yochanan, what's that beauty that we were talking about? So the commentaries on that say that's referring to a beauty that Rav Yochanan had from being connected to the city of Jerusalem. That wasn't in the text, but they explain that's what this beauty is. That Rav Yochanan's beauty is not just just his. His handsome,
good, you know, looks.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That there's something. There's a spiritual beauty that's there. Because again, that idea, the story that we'll have, where Rav Yochanan sitting outside the mikveh. Right. I told that over him. I gave over a class one time, and someone got so upset. They're like, "That's just off. What's he doing in front of a mikveh? That's just
right."
Right, and I explained. I said, "You don't understand. You're not talking about that." The guy, they asked Rav Yochanan, "Aren't you worried?" The question they asked him in that Gemara is, "Aren't you worried about the Ayin Hara, the evil eye?" And he says, "No, I'm not concerned about that. I come from Joseph. It says that Joseph and his offspring were not impacted by the evil eye." So it's a whole discussion about evil eye. Like, what does that mean exactly? But he said, I'm not affected by evil eye. So they ask on that, because there's another story where they ask the question, aren't you worried about it being inappropriate of like a woman, you seeing women coming out in that state? And he said, they don't even ask him that because he's so not in that realm of being challenged with that issue. Like he sees, like the other case was they ask the guy there and he says, I don't see the sexuality at all. There's no sexual play here in that case for me. At that point, Rav Yochanan is not concerned about that and he's not worried about Anayin Har, evil eye. Basically, he's not impacted by what others think and how others look.
Why is it there again?
Why is he standing there? Because he wants to. He felt that by them seeing his aura as they come out of the mikveh, that'll have a positive impact on the children that they're going to conceive.
It's like the most narcissistic thing, though. You know?
You see, so the question is, if you're you know, thinking like Donald Trump, right? Then yeah, of course it is. But if you're talking like Rav Yochanan, so let's talk. Who's Rav Yochanan again? Here he's lost 10 children. He walks around with a thing around his neck that reminds him of that. He's from he's connected back to the Holy Jerusalem. He's talking about someone who is on this, he's such a holy person. So, you know, it's like Rabbi Gamliel, right? Right? Someone like that. Right? So we went, so when we were in Jerusalem.
By the way, my son now says it.
Okay, so when we were in Jerusalem, I could send you a video so you understand, you'll see. You're talking about a man in probably in his late 80s, early 90s, who's got energy of a 17-year-old. It's remarkable. And he was like passionate in his, we sensed this man's love for all Jewish people. He was just incredibly, he was literally hopping. It was unbelievable. So when you meet something like that, and he's a we call that a me'ain. He's a taste of what Rav Yochanan must have been like. So Rav Yochanan, you're talking about a guy, you know, a holy person who is so connected to the spiritual realm. So when he does these things, it's not because he's narcissistic. His sense of he's basically so humble. He's removed the ego to as much as, you know, one can. And he's there because he wants to have a pause. He wants to share that spiritual, you know, energy that he has. So it's not a narcissistic thing. You have to always put the context together, understanding who Rav Yochanan was. So the case of Rabbi Elazar crying over his loss of the beauty of Rav Yochanan, it's not just a physical beauty; it's a spiritual beauty. He had like a glow. Like you'll meet people. Like I was very fortunate. When I studied in Israel 30 years ago, yeah, it's a little bit, so 30 years ago. So I was in Jerusalem, and I was with a friend, and we went to Daven at sunrise at a synagogue called the Gra. It's in Shari Chesed, and there was a big rabbi there. His name was Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And Rav Shlomo Zalman, it was like he was right there, 10 feet away, and he had a glow. I'm trying to pull up a picture so you could see. Let me just see if I can pick up. Okay, so here's a picture, but to see this person let me do a screen share. Hold on. Let me show you what I'm talking about here. Look at this. Okay, so you see this? He had this glow. I don't know if I'm getting the picture up here. Can you see it?
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, but that's just a picture. To see someone like that in person. An aura. And it was incredible. And I took my dad, I remember I took my father back to see that. And he also, same reaction. We were like, wow, that's what we're talking about here. So Rav Yochanan is, we're talking on a different level of aura. So that to be able to experience that, that's a very special, and that's, I guess, again, so that's bringing us to this, like what Rabbi Elazar saw, the loss of that beauty. So in a sense, like we're these are people that are on a high level. They're not, you know, like you said, a narcissistic. They're not. That's the opposite. They've worked their whole lives. They've suffered. They're connected. They care about, you know, other people. He's out there so that they can see it, because he wants to share it, not because he's it's like all about me. It's about because I have something special I want to give over and let other people benefit from. Okay, so that's the story there. So now the Gemara relates another story regarding acknowledgement of the justice of divine punishment. 400 barrels of Rav Huna's wine fermented and turned into vinegar, causing him great financial loss. Rabbi Huda, the brother of Rav Sala the Pious, along with the sages, and some say it was Rav Ada Bar Ava, along with the sages, entered to visit him. Okay, so they come in to see Rav Huna. They said, "Master should the master should examine his actions, as perhaps he committed a transgression for which he is being punished." Okay, so they walk in, they say, "Rav Huna, maybe this whole your major financial loss is because you did something wrong." So Rav Huna said to them, "Am I a suspect in your eyes? Have I committed a transgression on account of which you advise me to examine my behavior? Like, you know, are you pointing your finger at me?" So they said to him, "Is the Holy One, blessed be He, suspect that He exacts punishment without justice? Your loss was certainly just, and you must examine your conduct to find out why." The sages were aware of a flaw in Rav Huna's conduct to which they alluded. So they knew there was something a little bit off, and they wanted to, like, you know, say, hey, they connected the dots. They said, look, you just, by the way, just as a side, whenever you see the number 400 in the Gemara, in the Talmud, it's always an idea of like something really big. It's an exaggerated number, but it's saying like this is something like really big. So it's a great financial loss. So here is this guy, probably Rav Huna is pretty successful, and then his like whole fortune like turns and literally sours. So there was a rumor going around about something that was a little bit off. So they said, wait, major financial loss, and then we're hearing this like, you know, some kind of rumor. There must be that this is, you know, loss equals because of such and such bad behavior. So Rav Huna said to them, "If someone has heard something improper that I have done, let him say so." So they said to him, "We have heard that the master does not give a share of his grapevines to his tenant farmers. A tenant farmer is entitled to a portion of the crop grown on his landlord's property, as well as a share of the vines planted during the given year." Okay, so it's a sharecropper. So somehow Rav Huna, they heard that Rav Huna had not given the proper share to the tenant farmer. So Rav Huna said to them, "Does this tenant farmer leave me anything from the produce that he grows on my property? He steals it all." Meaning there's supposed to be a profit share. And the guy who's doing the work was not paying his proper, he was basically taking everything for himself. So consequently, in denying him his share of the grapevines, I am simply recouping that which was stolen from me by his tenant farmer. So basically, Rav Huna's tenant farmer was not giving him the proper payments. So Rav Huna said, this is crazy. So Rav Huna basically stopped, you know, giving him his share. And so he basically was taking the law into his own hands. So they said to him, that's the meaning of the folk saying, one who steals from a thief has a taste of theft. So they were basically saying, despite the fact that the property was stolen to begin with, one nevertheless engages in theft. Although he did not violate a prohibition per se, it is still a form of theft, and one who is held to a higher standard than others will be punished for it. So he said to them, I accept upon myself to give my tenant farmer his portion in the future. So right here we see that by the letter of the law, Rav Huna, by withholding, was kind of protecting his position. Right here, this guy who was working for him was basically taking all the stuff for himself. So Rav Huna took action and basically like would not, where he could have, where he was obligated to give a piece of whatever it was, he held it back because it was kind of like he was balancing out. Here, this guy took too much, so I'm going to take more on my side. That'll balance it out. But the Gemara says no. They were telling him, Rav Huna, first of all, you're judged to a higher standard. So in a sense, probably what should have happened is Rav Huna should have taken it to a court of law to have it adjudicated there. By him taking actions into his own hands, it looked like he was taking, like he was stealing it from back from the guy. So at that point, Rav Huna said, okay, you're right, I didn't do the right thing. So thereupon, as a result of Rav Huna's repentance, God restored his loss. Some say his vinegar turned back into wine, and some say that the price of vinegar rose and it was sold at the price of wine. So the situation corrected itself. So what we see here is that here is a case of where misfortune came to him in his business, and on the surface, he felt justified in what he had done. What they were telling Rav Huna was, God is sending a message to you through this massive loss that you were going to incur, that it's true, maybe on the surface you looked okay, but the reality is, now there are two things. You can ask yourself, is it that it could be construed? Because what they're saying is, it looks like you were stealing. Right, so is it that he was stealing, or that it's the impression, right? That let's say we say that they said to him, that's the meaning of the folk saying, one who steals from a thief has a taste of theft. Right, so despite the fact that the property was stolen to begin with, one nevertheless engages in theft. Although he did not violate a prohibition per se, it's still a form of theft, and one who has held to a higher standard than others will be punished for it. So we see that. The question is it that he's being held to a higher standard and that's why he was punished? Or is it that it also gave the impression that people could watch this and say, Rav Huna is, it looks like Rav, what is it?
Well, if he's kind of held to a higher standard, someone could see it and think that it's okay to do it. What happened here is, like, two wrongs don't make a right, meaning he took it into his own hands to rectify the situation. Like you said, it should have been brought to the handle through proper channels. Instead, people are looking at him and obviously thinking that he's stealing because the townspeople were talking about it.
Right. So
I think it actually has several different things. I think one, it talks about position of power, and when you're in a, just because you have the ability to do something, you necessarily can't. I think it also speaks to, Jonathan, I think you said it earlier, is that not only do you have to do the right thing, you can't do the right thing even if it looks like the wrong thing.
Correct.
Because, again, even though you're always supposed to look at the best thing, that doesn't always happen. So you can't, just because you're doing the right thing, if it appears that it could be wrong, you got to go further. You're held to a higher standard in the sense that you have to go further to make sure that it doesn't look like the wrong thing, even if it is.
Correct.
For example, I had asked a question about an ambulance driver, a Hustle ambulance driver that had gone on a call.
Okay.
And coming home Friday night at like 1 in the morning, he took off his yarmulke. Like, I saw his sitzis, and he wasn't wearing a yarmulke.
Right.
And I asked the question, why wasn't he wearing his yarmulke? And someone said to me, you know, it's quite possible he took off his yarmulke because when he was in the car driving on Shabbos, he didn't want someone to say, oh, look at the Jew driving on Shabbos.
Right.
Right.
Right. So that's, but it's interesting. I mean, here, this is a very timely, again, I don't like to criticize others, but like when a community is, you know, the optics are so important. So it's horrible. A big rabbi passes away and they want to give him a proper funeral. But if the optics are going to be bad, we have this idea that of Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name, is like in many situations takes precedence over everything. So if you're going to create a negative impression of the community by your actions, then it's a problem. So like to go out in that funeral and to make that, you know, as much as the reaction of the mayor is off base, which it is. But with that said, there's this idea of how the optics, what optics are, becomes very important. So again, within reason, like we have to always be careful. Like I've been studying Kilayim. Kilayim is where you're not allowed to mix certain certain plants together, certain fruits, certain seed. And in that, and you, as you go through the cases, you start to see that certain cases, the whole law is assessed based on how the optics are. If it looks like you're mixing them, even though you're really not mixing them, let's say you plant a vineyard, and it's next to something that you're not supposed to plant near it. It has to be spaced out. And if you properly space it, but then they're going to grow into each other, the optics are bad. So it becomes a prohibition. Like you're not even allowed to come to that place of where, even though it technically was spaced enough, but if it's going to come back and they're going to let, but the optics are important. So here we're seeing that Rav Huna, even though technically, but he's also, in another way to understand it, I think is also like they're saying, like, you know, it's true that you might be justified, but also one who steals from a thief has a taste of theft. Is like an idea that you kind of also lowering yourself to that person's level by acting in that way, that might also be part of this as well. Like the optics are very important. And also, you know, again, Rav Huna is justified, but then again, one who steals from a thief has a taste of theft. So it also, how that impacts you, like how you do things also has a major impact. And, in you know, many times, like when you get that, like in a sense, Rav Huna was on a high level because the fact that he's getting punished, so to speak, like you see there is an effect from his actions that God is sending him a very clear message is almost like a blessing because here he's able to self-correct. You know, that's the idea that you're going to get smack. You know, that God, like, hits us sometimes. That's actually, like, that means we're, you know, thank you, because I needed that. That's also, like, showing it's a testament to his being connected, so to speak. Okay.
Well, I think it also has, like, an element of, you know, we're all going to run into people that do things not the way we would do them. And it's a choice, okay, are you going to sort of respond in kind, and it's almost like to some degree like ceding control to the other person to set the standard of behavior. Like, hey, look, are you going, like, we each have our own, almost, you know, because here they're saying, look, you didn't really do anything wrong, you know, technically you can make the argument of what he was doing. You know, they say, look, you might not have violated a prohibition, but are you being true to yourself in your own standards? It's very easy, and not easy, but there's a often when somebody does something in a way that I don't like to speak like that, or that's just not my style, but hey, I have to respond in kind to, you know, make sure I'm getting my fair share.
Right.
Whatever it is.
So.
And you're not being necessarily true to either, whether it be a higher standard or just to your own, like, hey, that's not who you are.
Correct. Exactly. Right. So it's interesting. Like, you see this idea that he was definitely, we're saying, like, right, he's definitely one who steals from a thief has a taste of theft. It's like you're definitely being negatively impacted. And so you're worried about the op. You have to be, so the takeaway is, we have to never let ourselves, you know, get lowered down by those, you know, who are low, so to speak. And at the same time, also not to, you know, to also be concerned a little bit, you know, especially a guy like in Rav Huna's case, we're saying he's a high level person. He has to be careful. He has to worry about the optics. You know, maybe sometimes we don't necessarily as much, but I guess, you know, or maybe we're all in, you know, we should hold ourselves to a high standard, and therefore we should be concerned that people get the right, learn the right things from our actions as well. Okay.
Is there some sort of concept like, you know, maybe not in this case, but where like, hey, look, I know you have those lofty standards, but you're in the real world.
Right.
like you'd be like, you're in the real world now, like, yeah, that's nice, theoretically, and oh, if we lived in heaven, that's the way it would be. But right now, you're on this earth, and here are the operating principles here, and they're not always, you know, you're like, you have to,
You have to be practical. You want to say there should be, you should be practical, right?
For yourself, if I'm not for myself, who will be? Right.
So I think in that case, they probably would say, you know, take it to an arbitrator, take it to a court, as opposed to taking it into your own hands and take, you know, like meaning for the optics purpose, meaning you need to protect your interests. So that's what the courts are for. You know, I remember told someone, like, you know, it's terrible what happened in the situation. So the guy says to me, that's what the courts are for. You know, the Torah talks about having courts because there's a need to adjudicate, you know, conflicts. There are going to be conflicts and many times both sides have, you know, sound pretty reasonable. And so that's what the courts are for. And that's what arbitration's for. So in this case, we're saying that Rav Huna probably should have taken it outside of his own, you know, judgment and like rely on others to make, you know, the decision that would probably be in his favor so that everybody knows. So Rav Huna did the right thing. That this is the guy who was that sharecropper was a bad dude. But now it's clear to everybody. It wasn't Rav Huna that was, you know, it's an objective third party was able to make that decision. Okay. So now the Gemara returns to the topic of prayer. It was taught in a Braita that the Tana Abba Binyamin would say, all of my life I have taken great pains with regard to two things, that my prayer should be before my bed, and that my bed should be placed north to south.
Yeah.
Okay, so now what's going on here? So Abba Binyamin's statement requires explanation with regard to this statement, that my prayer should be before my bed. The Gemara asks, what does before my bed mean? If you say that it literally means that he would stand before his bed and pray, it's difficult, as Rav Yehuda said, that Rav said, and some say that Rav Yehoshua ben Levi said, from where is it derived that one who prays should have nothing separating between him and the wall? As it is stated, and Chizkiah turned to face the wall and prayed, in order to facilitate his concentration during prayer. That being said, why would Abba Binyamin pray before his bed? Rather, do not say that before my bed refers to where he stood during prayer, but rather say that he prayed adjacent to the time that he retired to bed. He was careful to recite Shema and recite the evening prayer just before going to sleep, like that's a principle we had learned before, right? So that Abba Binyamin statement, and my bed should be placed north to south. Okay, so that's the first point. Some say, it's interesting, the way this English explanation is reading is that it's talking about before he went to sleep, right? Before my bed. Others say that it refers to the flip side, but the same idea, that it was when he got up right away, when he woke up in the morning, he prayed, okay? But so he's saying that there's this idea of adjacent to going to sleep or awakening, that the first thing one should do is they should be praying. Right? I mean, meaning, I'm showing my priority. My priority is I'm connected to God. I want to connect to God. Therefore, right before I awaken or right before I go to sleep, that's what I'm doing because I'm that's where my priorities are. I want to have that interaction with God. Okay. So then he also says that he had his bed in a certain direction. So Abba Binyamin's statement, my bed should be placed north to south, was in deference to the divine presence, which rests between east and west, the direction of the temple, as the Holy of Holies was to the west, while the main entrance was to the east. Therefore, the sages were careful not to perform actions inconsistent with that sanctity while facing east to west, and therefore Abba Binyamin was careful not to sleep in a bed that faced east to west.
That seems to be the opposite of what you would expect.
Okay, what do you mean?
Because if the holiest of holies and there's this spiritual connection from east to west, wouldn't you think you want to be aligned with that rather than against, opposite it?
Right. So I guess he's saying that I'm going to say that's that type of sanctity, and this holy act of connecting, you know, sexually with one's spouse, but it's in a different plane. So I'm going to go in a different direction. Okay. So in praise of that stringency, the sages added that Rabbi Chama said that Rav Hanina said that Rav Yitzchak said, one who places his bed facing north to south will be rewarded with male children, as is stated, and whose belly you fill with your treasure which is based on the word Tzafon, which is north, who have sons in plenty and leave their abundance to their babies. This verse indicates...
I'm telling my beds were never north to south.
There's even more to this, by the way. I was like, am I going to go into this one in depth? There's a lot of interesting commentary on this that I saw with the Maral. He explains some of what's going on here. I mean, the Maral, the Ben Yoyada, like there's more going on here. So let me read the text, and then maybe we'll just touch on some of this. The verse indicates that one who sets his bed facing north will be rewarded with sons in plenty, as north, Tzafon, is etymologically similar to the word your treasure, which is usfuncha. Okay, so there's like a play on the word there. So not only that, Rav Nachman Yitzchak said, moreover, his wife will not miscarry. From where do we derive this? It is written here, and whose belly you fill, timale, with your treasure. And it is written there, concerning Rebecca's pregnancy, and her time to give birth was filled, right? Ve'imalu, that they were filled, and there were twins in her belly. Consequently, you fill with your treasure refers to a pregnancy that proceeds without complication. Okay, so what exactly is going on here? So like it could be the play on Tzafon is to be hidden, and Tzafon is north. So exactly how this is, you know, like what's the, there's clearly something very, there's a very deep idea here. Exactly what's going on. It's pretty lengthy. I'd kind of want to leave it for another time. So I just want to get into the next thing because it's like more of a straightforward idea. Maybe we'll come back to this. I actually, the next piece after this talks about God wearing tefillin, which I like to do next week, God willing. Maybe we'll do it as an opportunity. I wanted to give like a quick, like 10-minute tutorial on tefillin, on how to put it on, how what's the process of like putting on your talis, putting on tefillin. Maybe it's going to be 15 minutes, and then go into that. Next, it's not in this printed sheet, it's the next thing that's coming up, which talks about God's tefillin, our tefillin. What is God's tefillin? What does it mean that God wears tefillin? I mean, what does that mean? God's not physical, so how does God wear tefillin? But it's a very, this is already a two, maybe it's even a couple weeks of really digging deep into that Gemara. It's a very deep idea, beautiful stuff that comes out from the Maral on that. So, much more, I mean, this story about the North-South and male children, all that stuff, we could come back to it. I just wanted to, it's lengthy and, okay, I don't know, not sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so another of Abba Binyamin's statements with regard to the laws of prayer was taught in Embraita. Abba Binyamin says, if two people enter a synagogue outside of the city in order to pray, and one began praying before the other and did not wait for the other person to complete his prayer and left him alone in the synagogue, his prayer is thrown back in his face. Because he left the other person alone and caused him to be distracted during his prayer, his own prayer is thrown back in his face. As it is stated, you throw your soul in your face, for your sake will the earth be forsaken, the rock will be removed from its place. So this verse indicates that one who left the other person alone effectively causes his soul, as prayer is the outpouring of the soul before God, to be thrown in his face. God says to that person, for your sake, do you think because you left, the earth will be forsaken, that God will leave the world and the prayer of the other person will go unheard? So not only that, but it causes the divine presence to remove itself from Israel, as it is stated in the continuation of the verse, the rock will be moved from its place. The rock, God, is forced to remove his presence, and rock means nothing other than the Holy One, blessed be He, as it is stated, of the rock that gave birth to you, you have been unmindful, and you have forgotten God who bore you. But if the guy does wait for the person in the synagogue, what is his reward? So is his reward proportionate to the punishment received by one who failed to do so? In terms of this reward, Rav Yossi, the son of Rav Hanina, said, one who waits in the synagogue for the other person to finish his prayer merits the following blessings. As is stated, if only you had listened to my mitzvot, then your peace would be as a river, and your righteousness as the waves of the sea. Your seed would be as the sand, and the offspring of your body like the grains thereof. His name would be neither cut off nor destroyed before me. The explanation of this passage is based on the etymological similarity between the word mitzvah and the word tzevet, which means group. If he keeps the other person company and does not abandon him after his prayer, all the blessings that appear later in this verse will be fulfilled in him. So basically, if you leave the person and you end up adversely affecting them, so then all your prayer, God says, take your prayers back, goodbye, right? But if you're there for the person, it's almost like we're saying that, you know, it's this idea of the balance between God and our fellow man, that they go hand in hand. The idea of leaving someone, right, to leave someone alone and to distract their prayer and to diminish that is a horrible thing. And so therefore we see that blessing, to be connected, is the only way that you get blessing is when you're connected. It's almost like we look at these, the analogy is a pipe. And that the pipe is a flow of blessing. It's called a shefa. It's a flow of blessing that comes to us. Bracha, the word for blessing, is the idea of something that overflows, brecha. So when we think of blessing, it's this idea of a flow that's coming from above, that comes into this world and that flows down. It's a mystical idea, but it's really like, it's all the basis of what, when we say, you know, bracha, baruch atah, when we say to God is Baruch, blessed are you, we're saying blessing God. We're saying, no, you're the source of blessing. You're the source of the flow. So it's the analogy that's in the mystical world. The realm is always like they talk about the tzinarot, the pipes, that we have a pipe, you know, so to speak, that's open to like send us the blessing, the shefa, the flow. So that there's this flow that comes from above so that when everything is healthy, the flow is coming. Things flow. The blessing flows. That's the idea of blessing. God is the source of, that's why we say Baruch Atah. We're saying you, God, are the source of the blessing. It's not that you're blessed. No, you are blessing. You're the source of the blessing. You're the source of the flow. So when we are connected and we're doing right by our fellow man, so then blessing can come. That's part of the equation. But if we're not aligned with that, if we cause deficit for others, then the flow gets turned off and everything that we were trying to push towards God gets pushed right back at us. Because we want it to be, what we're looking for is that just as the flow comes from above down, we are looking to have the same type of connection going upward. So in this case of where the person is praying and then leaves the other guy alone to affect his concentration or his equanimity or you know just that peacefulness that should exist. So then, by impacting that other guy's you know ability to connect above, so that he's impacting the flow down, so that therefore he loses out and it's so to speak it's turned off, but. The flip side is that when he does the right thing, one who waits in the synagogue for the other person, for the other to finish his prayer, merits the following blessings, right? So if only you had listened to my mitzvot, then your peace would be as a river, right? You see this idea of flowing, and your righteousness as the waves of the sea. Your seed would be as the sand and the offspring of your body, like the grains thereof. His name would be neither cut off nor destroyed before me. So this idea that, seeing this idea of flow, that should be there, right? So when there's proper, when everything's in its proper state, then that's where we get the flow. So when you're doing things that allow for that connection to be, so then we have blessing. But the flip side is the opposite. So it goes like hand in hand. This is like, you know, when it's right, we have the opening, the flow comes in. And when it's not, we have the, unfortunately, God forbid, the opposite of it, of things being turned off. Any questions, comments before we... Okay. All right, as long as everybody's still awake. That's okay, so, but if that sounds like an idea, so next week they'll do like this. The Gemara goes into this unbelievable thing about God's tefillin. And it asks, you know, what is in God's tefillin? And we can then, from that, go into really what is it say in our tefillin. It's a whole very profound discussion about what tefillin is all about. Because if God's tefillin really correspond to our tefillin, and so, and then we have the two aspects. We have a tefillin that goes on our hands, on our arms, and then we have the tefillin that goes on our head. And so in that context, I wanted to like also like we could do a demonstration. Let's just go over like the basics of what's the order you put on your tallit first, what you say when you put on your tallit, and then also how we put on the, you know, the tefillin. What does each thing mean? Just as a very quick thing, we say that we put the tefillin on our arms, that it corresponds to our hearts. So we put it on our arm. So how does that, what does that have to do with our heart? So I guess you can't put it, strap it around your, you know, can you imagine you get there, you're like, you're going to strap the tefillin around your body so you can put it on your heart. But as a doctor, Hugh, what's the most effective way of being able to measure the person's heart on the body, besides putting something over your heart?
I mean, besides listening with a stethoscope?
Yeah.
Well, technically, if you look at taking blood pressure.
Right, where is that?
It's on the arm.
Right, where you put your tefillin, right?
Correct.
How cool is that?
That's pretty cool.
Okay. Because what is the heart? Heart is symbolic of how we react to things, right? When we get excited, our heart starts to race.
Yeah.
We're calm, it's slower. So the heart is the place that really shows how we react to outside stimulus or, you know, or in our head, whatever.
Yeah.
Right? And the place that measures that is between your shoulder and your elbow, is the best place to measure that besides being right over your heart. So I thought that was pretty cool that the place that you actually put the tefillin is connected. It runs parallel to the heart, to the place that you would measure how the heart reacts.
Interesting.
All right, cool little tidbit that I figured out like a couple years ago. I was like thinking about it, like, I asked my buddy, I'm like, can I ask you something? What's the best place to measure? He's like, yeah, right there. I'm like, yes. So you see that? That's like the idea. But, you know, that's like, it corresponds to your heart, right? So you can't, you know, so practically speaking, you put it on your arm, but that's really connected to your heart. And obviously the one that you put on your head is your brain, you know, that idea, or bene nacha, between your eyes. So we'll have to talk about that. All right.
Okay.
That's the story.
Everybody enjoy the gorgeous day.